the truth. Hey gang, welcome to National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the annoying itch of free speech. It's annoying, unless you scratch it. And this is how you scratch it, is you go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, follow the instructions for sending that badly needed fundage. Okay. Well, here we go. Are we going to do it again? Was the proxy war against Russia that, you know, we're so losing, that we're losing so badly, was that so much fun that we've got to do, like, now a hot war with China? Is that the deal here? Because actually, that seems like what the deal is. So what you got going on is, which you've probably heard, Nancy Pelosi. Nancy, aren't you glad that she's in charge of our Congress, in charge of one of our three co-equal branches of government? Isn't that reassuring? So Nancy Pelosi has decided to go to Taiwan. Why is she going to Taiwan? Well, I mean, you can call me paranoid. I would say it's a provocation. Although there is an alternative explanation that is actually plausible, that she's got corrupt business dealings, right? I mean, for her insider trading purposes, because she says she's going in a private capacity. And if she's going in a private capacity, well, what does she do in a private capacity besides, screw up our government? Well, she does insider trading. So maybe it has to do with her insider trading activities. You know, we'll, I guess, keep an open mind for that. But otherwise, it seems like this is just a provocation. And the Chinese are protesting against these plans and issuing really the sternest warnings ever. Now, in response to these stern warnings, the United States is moving, what, an Air Force carrier group towards Taiwan? Really? To protect Nancy Pelosi's either her provocation or her insider trading activities? Really? You're going to mobilize a carrier task force or whatever it's called? You're going to do that? The whole thing seems bizarre, and I don't want to be a broken record. I don't do this too often, but just to recap what the Taiwan thing is about, the history, is Taiwan itself. Okay, excuse me. So the deal is that, actually, if you go back to the times that Englishmen were colonizing what became the United States. If you go and, you know, colonizing who lived here at that time, it was American Indians. Taiwan actually was inhabited by Filipino-type people. They were actually the ancestors. The people who lived in Taiwan, the Aborigine people, not the people who live there today, there's, with the exception of like a minority of 1% or less, but this little minority of Aborigine people in Taiwan, they are the ancestors of all the people in the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, even Polynesia. But around the same time that the Englishmen were colonizing the eastern seaboard of the United States, you were getting Chinese traders who were going to Taiwan and starting to colonize it. Of course, at the same time, because we're talking about the 1600s, you were getting Dutch and Portuguese who were also dropping by. So in a way, the thing is, the best argument you can make that that Taiwan doesn't have a long Chinese history. To the extent you can make that argument, it's an argument that, like, China, that Taiwan would belong to this tiny 1% minority. The people who are live in Taiwan today are about like 99% Chinese. They're Chinese people. And so these people, when did they come? Well, they started coming, like I said, in the 1600s. Really big time, they were coming in like early 1800s, mid-1800s. They were coming big time. Now, here's... And Taiwan was part of the Chinese Empire. So Taiwan, it doesn't have the long history in the Chinese Empire that other regions have, which can go back thousands of years. But it was part of the Chinese Empire going into the modern, in the modern era. And it was part of the Chinese Empire when in 1894, the Japanese fought a war against the Chinese Empire. And as a result of that war, the Japanese took over Taiwan. So in 1895, Taiwan was ceded to Japan. The population was a Chinese population, and the Japanese held on to that island for 50 years, the next 50 years, until the end of World War II. And at the end of World War II, the Taiwan, with its Chinese population that speaks Chinese, speaks a version of Chinese, a Chinese language which is mutually intelligible with the Chinese language on the other side of the straits, Fujian province. So it's basically Fujianese. So this population and the territory was given back to China. Now, the Chinese Empire no longer existed, so it was given to the Republic of China, which had been founded in 1911 by Sun Yat-sen, and which never actually controlled all of the territory of the Chinese Empire, because you had warlords, because you had the Japanese had been occupying big parts of it. Manchuria had been split off by the Japanese into an independent country, nominally independent country, really run by the Japanese. And Mongolia had been split off into an independent country and remained such. But at any rate, Chiang Kai-shek was the internationally recognized leader of the Republic of China, which the Republic of China claimed sovereignty over all these areas, including Manchuria, including Mongolia, including some western border regions that are now controlled by Pakistan and India and Tajikistan and places like that, Kazakhstan. So, this Chinese Empire, or this Chinese Republic of China, that had been founded in 1911, internationally recognized government of China. In the 1920s, after the death of Sun Yat-sen, it wound up getting taken over by General Chiang Kai-shek. And so Chiang Kai-shek is a name that you all should know, Chiang Kai-shek. So he was the leader of the Republic of China, which was allied to the United States and the other allies during World War II. And it was one of the five victorious powers. And it was one of the five original members of the UN Security Council. Okay, so that's what you had. So in 1945, when the Japanese surrendered, the government, the Republic of China government, which at the time was capitaled in Nanjing on the mainland, it took over Taiwan from the Japanese, and Taiwan had this Chinese population. And then, of course, in 1945, the surrender of the Japanese didn't mean the end of the war in China, because China had been in a state of civil war, really, for decades. They had been in this state of civil war. And by 1945, the civil war was mainly between the nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek, headquartered in Nanjing, and Mao Zedong's communists. And this continued, and over the next 4 years, the communists, who had spent much of World War II way out west, they came east and they were beating the nationalists. And Chiang Kai-shek, in his wisdom, seeing that he was losing to the communists, Chiang Kai-shek evacuated his government and his army and his elite to Taiwan, which was much more defensible. It's a fairly large island off the coast of China. It's got enough separation that it would have been hard for Mao's rebel army, for his army to cross the Taiwan Straits and take Formosa. Formosa is another name for Taiwan. So by 1949, you had a new wave of Chinese immigration onto the old wave. So the old, the pre-existing people in Taiwan, as of 1945, these were people whose ancestors had come from just across the straits in Fujian province and spoke the language or dialect, if you will, spoken in Fujian province, just across the straits. In 1949, you started getting this wave that might have wound up adding another 15 or 20% to the population of Taiwan. So there was a lot of people, who mostly men. So there was the government, it was the military, it was the elite who fled the mainland, who fled Mao Zedong's army to set up a bastion for the Republic of China on Taiwan. And they still claimed to be the government. And this government, of course, it had been moving its capital around over the years. It had moved its capital during World War II, when the Japanese took over Nanjing. They moved their capital up the Yangtze River to Chongqing, or Chongqing as it was called in America. So they had moved their capital, and as far as they were concerned, they were just moving their capital again because of military necessity. They were moving their capital to Taipei. It was still the Republic of China. So this, as far as the government that was in the government of the Republic of China, they were just moving their capital to Taipei temporarily, just as they had moved temporarily during World War II, moved their capital to Chongqing to avoid the Japanese military. Now they're moving their capital and their government to Taipei to avoid Mao and his communists. And in 1949, Mao set up the rival People's Republic of China with a capital in Beijing. Peking is as it was called at the time, in the West. So you had two rival governments, both claiming to be the government of China. This was the situation. This is why we talk about one China or two Chinas. And it wasn't North China and South China. It was Red China and Nationalist China. And the Red China, the communists, controlled the mainland. And they did get control of Manchuria. They never attempted to get control of Mongolia, which had been part of the Chinese Empire in the previous century. They gave up on that. They gave up actually on some of the frontier lands in the far west, which the government in Taipei, the nationalist government, never gave up. So that's how we got to this point. What happened after 1949 was you had Chiang Kai-shek, who continued to live for, I can't remember what year he died. I think he died around 1972 or something. He lived for a good long time. Or maybe, I can't remember off the top of my head. But at any rate, he tried to maintain a strong army, an army that one day would be capable of invading the mainland, maybe with some help. You know, in fact, according to I.F. Stone, who was a Jewish investigative writer, reporter of the mid-20th century, Chiang Kai-shek and some of his associates had something to do with the start of the Korean War, that they were actually angling for a big Asian war in order to, you know, bring in the Americans into a war against the Chinese communists so that they could retake the mainland. But this dream of the nationalist government of the Republic of China based in Taipei, this dream of it conquering China, when I first went to Taipei in the early 1980s, that was still out in the open, that this was their intention. And when the TV would come on, because a lot of Americans take TV for granted, that it's on all the time, or us boomers, we're old enough to remember, okay, it comes on at like 5 a.m. and goes off at 1 a.m. There would be or it goes off at midnight. There would be a time, if you woke up too early, there was no TV, it was just test patterns. Or if you stayed up too late, you know, you'd see the national anthem, and then they would cease broadcasting for several hours for the night. And in other countries, I guess that had less programming, the hours of operation of TV was a lot shorter. And so in Taipei in the early 1980s, you would have some programming in the morning, it would go off in the afternoon, and then it would come back on again in the evening for programming. So there was only like maybe 10 hours of programming per day, something like that. And when the programming would start, you would get this patriotic video. It's like a patriotic newsreel that would show a bunch of images, and the images were of, you know, the nationalist Chinese army, and of basically depicting a war in which the nationalist Chinese army would prevail and liberate the mainland. And this was every day. And if you went to a movie, there would be a little 1-minute newsreel before whatever other newsreels and main features they were going to have. And this is what it would depict. It would depict what I remember specifically from both the TV and the movies was you would see a map of China with Taiwan being of exaggerated size, because it's not that large, but it would be an exaggerated size, and superimposed on the island of Taiwan would be the nationalist Chinese flag, which has a kind of sun-like thing in its upper left-hand corner, and then rays would start coming out from the sun. And the mainland was red, but these rays would push the red off of the map of mainland China. And once the red was gone, you saw all of these happy people on the mainland, and they're all waving the nationalist flag. Okay, we'll be right back.
あの Tennessee World the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Okay, we are back, and I went back and checked, and Chiang Kai-shek lived until 1975, by which time he was like 87 or 88. He was president until his death in 1975. And so, and I think there might have been a brief period where somebody else was president, but then his son took over, Chiang Ding-kuo. Chiang Ding-kuo, and they couldn't really start a dynasty, because Chiang Ding-kuo had been married to a Russian, and so his own... children were half Russian, and I don't think that really would have flown. At any rate, oh, and you might ask, why Russia? And the thing is, the nationalist government, the nationalist party under Sun Yat-sen and then later Chiang Kai-shek in the 1920s, they actually had a certain amount of. Not as much Chiang Kai-shek, but Sun Yat-sen had a certain amount of socialist ideology. They were kind of influenced. And, of course, for a while, Mao's movement was operating as a part of the Nationalist Party. They didn't start as part of the Nationalist Party, but they merged into it for a brief period of time, and then they split away from it. But the Nationalist Party, founded by Sun Yat-sen, I believe it was founded by Sun Yat-sen. It was led by Sun Yat-sen and then later led by Chiang Kai-shek. They actually had a fair amount of influence from Soviet Russia And the party was set up along Leninist organizational lines. So you had a Politburo and a Central Committee. Very odd, especially during the Cold War and especially during its very anti-communist phase, because it became very, very anti-communist in the, you know, obviously, during the Cold War. And yet it had a Politburo and a Central Committee, and it was structured along, organizationally, it was modeled after the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Fun fact, and Chiang Kai-shek had sent his own son, Chang Jingguo, over to Moscow to study. And so Chang Jingguo had brought home a Russian wife. How about that? Anyway, so during the Cold War, when a boomer like myself was growing up, the thing was that, you know, you had the five members of the UN Security Council, which were the Soviet Union. They were the winners of World War II, the Soviet Union, Britain, America, France, which, you know, is thrown in there to be nice to, be nice to De Gaulle or whoever, because the French actually kind of switched sides in the middle of the war, but whatever. Half of it was occupied by France, and the other half was Vichy, which was neutral, but friendly to Germany. But still, they were given England. They wanted, and Churchill wanted the French to be considered allied countries that were victorious. They wanted a French partner in Europe after the war, so France. And then what was the fifth country? China. Well, who held the seat? It was Chiang Kai-shek's government. And of course, when the United Nations really started operations, was that 1947? I think it was a San Francisco treaty that founded the United Nations. I believe that was 46. And the actual operations, did they start in 47 or did they start in 46? At any rate, at that time, Chiang Kai-shek's government was still on the mainland, and it had the seat. And even after it fled to Taiwan, and Mao proclaimed the Republic, the People's Republic of China in 1949, he wasn't given the seat on the United Nations Security Council. He wasn't recognized by the international community, and so the seat, the United Nations membership, was retained by the Republic of China, by Chiang Kai-shek. The People's Republic was not part of the United Nations, and I think that was 72 or 73, when it wasn't until 1971. It wasn't until 1971 that the People's Republic of China replaced the Republic of China as the recognized member of the UN, 1971. So all through the 50s and the 60s, the government in Taipei was not just a member of the UN, but it was a member of the Security Council, one of the five victorious powers. It had veto power. So that changed in 1971. Things were changing because in order for that change to occur, you had to have the agreement of the other four members of the Security Council. Now, the Soviets were in favor of the People's Republic of China being recognized, and in fact, they were boycotting proceedings in 1950 for that very reason, which is why the United Nations Security Council could allow the United States to lead a UN army in Korea, because the Soviets had been boycotting over the China issue. Hey, we're at the break. We're going to be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on long-term food storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
Tune in Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 Central, to the Alternative Media with your host, Farron. If you've not been listening, this is some of what you've been missing.
2,000 mules. Like you like to say occasionally, Farron, in your face.
They might have a set of lactating mammaries available that could provide milk for their adopted children.
Listen, news media, all pulling off this gigantic fraud.
Rhino, neocon, cucks.
There's this wonderful thing that's called Vote With Your Feet. Move to California.
I am a conspiracy factualist and everyone else is a reality theorist.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of ships came out of nowhere.
Give me liberty or let's give you death.
Any excuse to go in and kill yourself for this fraud of a government. This goes back 100 years.
When they come for your gold, give them a lead. And when they come for your guns, give them the bullets first. And God help us all.
Extendivite really works. Here's just a few testimonials from Amazon. RL, 5 stars. Been taking this for 2 months now. I feel better. Have more energy. April, my husband started taking Extendivite, and he said he feels much better and has more energy. EW, need to try. Everyone needs this for their health. Great product, great people. Josie, it works great. This product has made my blood pressure and cholesterol stable. I highly recommend it. JC, great product. Has worked well these last few years. To get your Extendivite today, go to extendivite.com. That's extendovite.com. Or call us at 1-877-928-8822.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Sayonara. Lopato.
Okay, welcome back. And during the break, I checked. Actually, I said about 1% of the Taiwanese population was these aborigines, these Malay aborigines, the ancestors of the Malay and Filipino people. Actually, it's more like 2 to 2.5%. It's still a tiny minority. And the rest are basically Han Chinese, regular Chinese people. Which means that the population of Taiwan is a higher percentage Chinese than the population of mainland China is. Anywho, and during the 50 years that the Japanese ruled Taiwan, there was a certain amount of economic development, although it was mainly agricultural. It wasn't so much, and you know, infrastructure. There was infrastructure for sugar was big, you know, other agricultural products and. Taiwan was largely integrated into the Japanese economy. The Taiwanese industrial growth, that actually did take place under the rule of the Nationalist Party, and the irony here is that the Nationalist Party, when it was in charge of the mainland, didn't do very well economically. Now, of course, there was a world war going on, a civil war and a world war, and they never really had a chance to develop in peace. In the period from 1949 through, say, let's just say 1975, when Chiang Kai-shek died, you had peace. And in fact, you've had peace on the island ever since. You've had peace, even though it's in a high state of military preparedness. For a variety of reasons, which we don't need to go into, but, you know, some U.S. aid, U.S. trade relations, other things, the industry under the Nationalist Party in Taiwan, it grew, and they had a lot of factories and a lot of industrial production, and by the 1980s, they were major exporters of electronic goods and other things to the rest of the world. So they, but to the United States in particular. So that's what you had. By the 1980s, Taiwan was middle class, and you know, obviously, when I say middle class, it didn't look like a suburban neighborhood of in New Jersey, but you know, it's still. But when I meant middle class in terms of the world. So people, they didn't need to work. They had plenty of food. They didn't have cars. They were going around on motor scooters, but, you know, buzzing around on their motor scooters. Everybody had food. Everybody had work. Everybody had a place to live, and people were able to raise their families. And it was middle income. It was a middle income country, and you didn't see a whole lot of beggars on the street. It was, people were doing reasonably well. And a lot of industry, petrochemicals, plastics, things like that, electronics. It was a serious economy. China, under Mao Zedong, they wound up spinning their wheels for a couple of decades. Maybe they were doing okay in the early 50s. They were doing okay, probably doing pretty well, up until the mid-50s, and then they did this whole Great Leap Forward, which was a disaster. We don't have to go into that. You can look it up if you want. But basically where they just tried to industrialize the countryside and agriculturalize the cities. It was just retarded. And then the Cultural Revolution, which was chaos. So they had a couple of wasted decades there, and they were way behind. And China, when I went to China in the 80s, it was as poor as, it was poorer than Morocco. I've never been to sub-Saharan Africa, but it was extremely poor. It was Indonesia was also poor. I don't know what was, but it was perhaps the poorest country I'd ever been to. It was extremely poor in the 1980s, mainland China. What happened was, you know, Chiang Kai-shek died, and then Chiang Jingguo, his son, took over. Chiang Jingguo was old enough when he took over, and then he wound up dying in, what, 1988. And the thing is, during while Chiang Jingguo was president, when Chiang Kai-shek was leading the government in Taipei, it was very, very much a government that had of this elite from the mainland who had fled with him. Under Chiang Jingguo, Chiang Jingguo started letting in the ethnic Chinese people who had already lived in Taiwan under the Japanese and before. So you were getting the Chinese who had been born in and who for a number of generations had been living in Taiwan. They were allowed into positions of power, including Li Tonghui, who, after Chiang Jingguo died, Li Tonghui was his successor. Li Tonghui was somebody who had been born in China. I mean, sorry, born in Taiwan, a Chinese person born in Taiwan, somebody of Hakka descent, for those whom that means something. And of course, by this time, you know, one of the things was the Republic of China had elections, not that it wasn't authoritarian and not that the elections were necessarily fair or whatever, but it had elections. And it was the entire Congress or Parliament or whatever fled the National Assembly, I guess it was called. They fled to Taiwan along with Chiang Kai-shek and continued to meet. They continued to hold sessions representing, you know, cities, Beijing or Shanghai or Wuhan or Yinchuan or whatever. They were just representing their cities. And, of course, they couldn't hold elections anymore, so they were just frozen in place. And over the years, people were getting old and dying, and so if somebody, the member of the National Assembly representing this district in Wuhan died, they would let the second place finisher take his place. And so they were continuing to meet, but it was, as the decades went by, this was becoming increasingly tenuous. And under Chang Jingguo, they started adapting the system so that the National Assembly was no longer representing these areas under bandit control. This is what they talked about, the mainland. The mainland was controlled by communist bandits. And so they stopped the representation of areas under bandit control. And so you wound up with a National Assembly that reflected just the people who lived in Taiwan and not reflecting people from the mainland. Which, that's the death of Chang Jingguo and Li Tonghui taking over, the increasing democracy in China, in Taiwan, where the elections are more and more meaningful, and where the elections are representing the people who vote in Taiwan, but not making any pretense of representing the people in communist bandit occupied mainland. Well, now you wound up going into the 1990s with a situation where it was the will of the people in Taiwan was being reflected, which it really hadn't been so much. And opinion in Taiwan is divided, okay? And this is shown by the fact that the Nationalist Party, which is a party that has its roots in the mainland, the Nationalist Party set up by Sun Yat-sen in, 1911 or whenever, these people who went through several decades of wanting to reconquer China and defeat the communist bandits and take control of the mainland, that was the default position of the Nationalist Party, which is still one of the two big parties. So you've got the Nationalist Party, one of the two major parties. And even now, while they don't necessarily want to conquer China, they do foresee a date in the future where there could be a peaceful reunification, the way there was a peaceful reunification of Hong Kong with the mainland. And then you've had the People's Progressive Party, as I was called, though, the Democratic Progressive Party, which has not looked forward to eventual reunification, but and which, while it may favor independence, to declare independence is to declare war, because the government in Beijing, the Chinese government of the People's Republic of China, they and the nationalist government in Taipei, they had an uneasy understanding that there was just one China. The disagreement was who was a legitimate government, and the thing is that in the 1980s with Chang Jingguo and later Li Tonghui, you started getting an unfrosting of relations between Taiwan and the mainland, and the Taiwanese had developed industry and they had capital, and it's a small island, and they were developing petrochemicals, which are really stinky, by the way. If you've ever been to New Jersey, you know what I'm talking about. But they're very stinky, very polluting, and they sought to be able to, well, to spread their industrial enterprises across the straits into, in particular, Fujian province, which was where you had linguistic ties, and it was very close by. And so you started getting a lot of cross-straits investment from Taiwan into mainland China in the 1980s. And so you were having actually very good economic relations in the 80s and 90s. And I know I've mentioned this many times. Mainland China's economic miracle, it wasn't because all of a sudden the Jews in America decided to invest in China. It wasn't that the Jews decided to send American jobs and factories to China. That's not what happened. What happened was Chang Jingguo and later Li Tonghui decided to allow Chinese industrialists living in Taiwan to invest in mainland China. The big push for Chinese industry, to the extent it came from outside China, came from Taiwan, not from America. And then to the extent it wasn't from Taiwan, it was from the Chinese diaspora around Southeast Asia. Okay, so it was Chinese investing, Chinese who didn't live in the mainland investing in China. That's where it came from. But so he had this uneasy relationship with both the governments in Beijing and Taiwan, and Taipei, claiming to be the legitimate government of all of China. And it was accepted, and it was known that if there was a break from the status quo, that would mean war. So if the Republic of China, that was Taiwan, if they started saying, okay, we're not the Republic of China, we're the Republic of Taiwan, and we no longer seek reunification, we no longer seek to conquer China, that it was known that that would lead to war. And that's the situation. And like it or not, that's the situation. And the thing is, half the people in Taiwan vote for the Nationalist Party. The elections tend to be very, very close, very close. And half the people vote for this DPP. And that's your situation. And the government in Beijing, they are completely content to play the waiting game. As long as the status quo is maintained, there's no war. As long as the status quo is maintained, the government in Beijing, in Taiwan, can continue to act independently. They can continue to be de facto independent, but they can never be de jure independent. They can never declare independence. This has been the deal. Like it or not, this is the deal. That the government in Taiwan can be de facto independent as long as they never claim legally to be independent. With the idea that Chinese are confident, the Chinese in Beijing are confident that sooner or later there will be a reunification, and they're prepared to play the long game. And so the irony is that the declaration of independence by Taiwan would cease the de facto independence of Taiwan. A declaration of legal independence by Taiwan ends the de facto independence of Taiwan. It would lead to a war, which Taiwan would lose, and it would be absorbed by China. Okay? So, and this, I'm sorry, if you're an American or some other foreigner, really, this is not our business. It's not our business. And why Nancy Pelosi and the Biden and Mitch McConnell and all these other people, why they want to, I mean, the prince, is this just so horrible? Is this such a horrible situation that we've got to do something about it? Should there be a World War III? The thing is, there under no circumstance is Taiwan going to be able to declare themselves independent of China and continue on the way they are. Okay, either they would declare independence and lose their independence and be absorbed into China, or they would be destroyed militarily. I mean, I haven't been to Taiwan in a long time, but you look at pictures and it's very affluent, it's very built up, beautiful buildings, beautiful infrastructure, railroads, everything. Are you going to surrender that just because of some principle, just because you want to be able to fly your own flag? And by the way, if they declared independence, they would be coming up with a new flag anyway. The flag that they use is the flag of the Republic of China. So, I mean, what is it? Is it worth sacrificing all of these buildings, all these, well, lives, of course, but all these buildings, everything? For some principle that you want to have a seat at the United Nations or whatever, it really makes no sense. And this is the height of recklessness. Now, why would anybody in Taiwan want this? Probably because there's a lot of anti-communist party sentiment around Asia. There's a lot in in Japan, there's a lot in Korea. And so there are people who don't like the idea of even in the distant future being united. Remember, under Chiang Ching-kuo, or under Chiang Kai-shek in particular, there was massive anti-communist indoctrination of the population. So you had that. So part of this anti-communism, which, and anti-CCPism, which feeds the Democratic Progressive Party, the pro-independence faction, a lot of this, at least a certain amount of it, has to do with the anti-communist party propaganda that they were subjected to for decades by the Nationalist Party, which is actually the party that seeks eventual unification.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
American Freedom News is your daily website that will keep you fully informed on what both the good guys and bad guys are doing in the information war in which we are all engaged. Fed up with the lies of the fake news media and the censorship of big tech giants? American Freedom News is the solution, as we provide truth and knowledge on all the vital issues of the day. American Freedom News believes in America first. The establishment wants us split into numerous hostile groups rather than uniting in a common cause against the corrupt oligarchy that is plundering America and the world. Many more Americans are waking up and realizing they are the victims of the ongoing Great Replacement and Great Reset. But the malevolent forces trying to systematically destroy America can and will be defeated. Be fully informed by reading American Freedom News, the best news and information site on the internet. Go to AmericanFreedomNews.us and find out for yourself. That's AmericanFreedomNews.us.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Black Owl Coffee, and I started Black Owl because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Communist Party propaganda that they were subjected to for decades by the Nationalist Party, which is actually the party that seeks eventual unification. So there's a lot of ironies here. But the thing is, bringing it back up to the current era, the current year, the last thing we need is for some sort of military... Like, you can look at what's going on in Ukraine and say, okay, well, it didn't lead to World War III. We've got our war with Russia. It's a proxy war. And all right, so Ukraine is going to stop existing in any kind of recognizable form. At least, you know, a big hunk of its territory is going to be lost. Maybe the majority of its territory, maybe all of its territory. Has it been that bad? I mean, we've got inflation and a lot of political and economic instability. But has it been that bad? Hasn't it been pretty cool? Don't we feel pretty good about flying that blue and yellow flag? And wouldn't we like to? Well, what flag would we fly? The thing is, if we tried to do a rerun of this with Taiwan or do a remake, right? The Ukraine War, Taiwan edition. What flag are we going to fly? The Republic of China flag? Because there is no flag for an independent Taiwan. There isn't one. So we're going to start waving the Republic of China flag. People are stupid enough that they would do that. But it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, I think I've talked past the break. In fact, I guess I did talk past the break. So we're coming up towards the end of the show. I guess we got a couple more minutes. But, you know, if you did this, if you declared independence, what's it going to look like? We've got a naval task force headed off to Taiwan. Is that going to get attacked with Chinese hypersonic missiles? Then what happens? Our Navy gets attacked by China. What does Tucker Carlson do? Tucker Carlson's been really pushing for war with China, and this is really dangerous. And the MAGAPEDs, unfortunately, the MAGAPEDs are going to start saying, Beijing, Joe Biden, he's soft on China. There's going to be this push for a real war with China. Then what happens? And China's got intercontinental ballistic nuclear weapons. I mean, ICBMs, that's what they're called. This is insane. And it could potentially be direct between China and the United States. And of course, the United States has these bases around Asia, in South Korea and in Japan in particular. They could become targets. And this really could be World War III. And is it worth it over Nancy Pelosi? Shouldn't we just tell Nancy, do your insider trading some other time? And if that's a diplomatic embarrassment, so what? I mean, this is just insane. Nancy Pelosi. So I don't know. Are we that crazy? So this is something to watch out for. And it's something that Nancy's trip is planned for, I'm not sure what date, but coming up in August. And so this is something we're almost in August now. So you gotta keep an eye out for it and know that this is absolutely insane. And unfortunately, it's probably going to be kind of bipartisan insanity because the MAGAPEDs, because of Tucker Carlson and some others, they're all anti-China. And the Democrats are going to support Nancy Pelosi. And anyway, well, all right, that's that. I'll be back again next time with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio.
only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.